Okay, no, we're fine.
So if I talk at this level, that's getting me through all right?
Oh, yeah.
Name is William Cronon, C-R-O-N-O-N again?
Yep. All right, so this is the second interview with Bill Cronon. We're here again in his office in Science Hall. This is an interview to add to our UW-Madison Archives Oral History Collection. The interviewer is Troy Reeves from the Oral History Program. Bill, let's jump right in because I know we don't have a lot of time. So as you matriculated to Memorial High School, I think you mentioned, well, you mentioned your interest in science. You mentored a biology club.
Yeah.
I guess my question basically is, as you matriculate, are there things you start to do at Memorial High that starts to sort of lessen this interest in caving and move on to a sort of another project or another period in your life?
Yeah, I guess I would say that's true. I don't remember the exact year that Memorial opened. It might have been 66, but I could be misremembering that. It might be 65, I'm not sure. But when I was the first, I was in the group of kids who opened that building, meaning when it opened, I was in the seventh grade. There was a brief period, maybe just a couple of years, when the junior high and the high school were all in one building before they built the middle school that now is behind Memorial High School. So I actually went from seventh grade through 12th grade at Memorial. And I was still very actively involved in caving through my junior high years, but by the time I got into high school, by ninth grade, that was beginning to diminish. So that was the time that I did the Sandstone Caves of Wisconsin project that I mentioned in our last interview. What I would say about Memorial High School, I don't have super strong memories of my junior high years, was that it was a brand new school. It was the 60s. It had attracted, by and large, a very enthusiastic and innovative group of high school teachers who were there, and it had a radically different way of organizing time in the high school day, as I mentioned last time, where the day was divided not into 7 or 8 one-hour units, but rather into 21 modules that were each 20 minutes long, so that you could teach courses of sort of any length within those 20-minute modules. If you wanted a 6-module course as a teacher, you could do that. If you wanted a 2-module course, you could do it that way. And especially, students who wanted individualized instruction could do it easily within that framework as well. And the mathematics department was probably the one that did that most aggressively. They developed something called UniPacks in the days of programmed learning, where students could work their way through algebra or geometry or pre-calculus or calculus in an individualized learning way, working through these study guides that the math department, with enormous labor, generated at that place. And the modular system was perfectly designed to match that. I mentioned last time that my brother managed to go through the modular UniPacks for all of mathematics, from algebra through calculus, in about a year and a half using that system. It affected me, I would say, most because the teachers at Memorial were very open to students who had unusual, quirky ways of thinking about what it was that they wanted to do in high school, and the system was well suited to those kinds of students. I think it was actually less well suited to students who wanted a more structured kind of day. But I was the perfect kind of student for this modular learning and flexible individual approach. Probably one of the ways I benefited was that I was hired by the Madison Public Schools to develop a series of film strips and slideshows. This was sort of the last major activity related to caving that I did in high school. I actually produced 3 slideshows on caving, on caves, one on geology, one on cave exploring as an activity, and I don't even remember what the third one was, but they were actually then distributed all around the Madison Public School System and around other school systems in Wisconsin as well, on the caves of Wisconsin. I also did a show called Down These Fair Streets that was a kind of environmental slideshow, which also attracted a lot of attention. These are important because I would go on in my formal teaching, when I started being a formal teacher myself at Yale, largely teaching with images. So slideshows actually have been a big part of my consciousness of how to communicate information to people all the way back to junior high. I would say I began doing slideshows based on backpacking trips that my family did in the West. I think my very first slideshow was on a trip we took to the bottom of the Grand Canyon that was mingled with geology and environmental history and all that, even before I knew I was interested in environmental history. And that is now the way I teach. I'd say that 90% of my class lectures are now PowerPoint, but they go back to 35mm slide making and are kind of an artifact of that way of teaching that I first began to play with back in junior high. So those slideshows I did for Local Materials, which is the office at Madison Public Schools, have gone on to be a defining part of my identity as a lecturer, as a teacher, as a photographer, as a writer. All those elements have been part of my communications identity very, very far back, and photography remains a passion of mine that deploys itself in my teaching in lots and lots of ways. You asked about biology. There was at Memorial High School a teacher named Leroy Lee, who was one of these innovative teachers who came in. He was working on a PhD in botany, I think it must have been, aquatic botany, at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, actually doing research on a species called Isoides muricata, which was a water plant common in Wisconsin wetlands, lakes, and rivers. And what was remarkable about Leroy Lee was that he taught biology, as many of the Memorial teachers did, so that even high school students came to have a knowledge of not just the information of science, but the practice and the process of science. That's something that I think was much more common in science teaching post-Sputnik. It was part of, I think, the Cold War effort to catch up with the Soviet Union, where a whole series of curricular innovations happened across the country. Memorial was very much at the cutting edge of these, where science became not so much a textbook activity for high school students, but a research activity. You were supposed to learn science by running experiments and all that kind of stuff. And Lee was really quite superb at this. His general biology courses were all experiment and field-based. We would go out and do field work. There was a course he taught toward the end of one's high school career that was called the Biology Research Seminar, where a group of high school kids, juniors and seniors, would do major original research projects in biological science. Mine, interestingly, was a massive project. I never did things on a small scale as a student, which sought to reconstruct the pre-settlement, pre-settlement vegetation of Sauk County, Wisconsin, using the original land survey records. And I spent probably hundreds of hours looking at the original land survey records and looking at the species for every quarter section point of every square mile, every township in the county of Sauk to the northwest of Dane County, and then reconstructing the vegetation patterns there. So even then, back then, that would have been maybe 11th grade, I was doing what we would now call a kind of environmental history or historical ecology. Loved doing it, and that too would feed into my later interest in environmental history. But in addition to that research seminar, Lee also had something called the Biology Honors Society, which was a club for students interested in the life sciences and in biology at Memorial High School. It was a remarkable club and drew a remarkable group of high school students, many of whom became my closest friends. Most of my closest friends, I would say, were in this Biology Honors Society. And because it was the late 60s and early 70s, Biology Honor Society inevitably had a strong interest in ecological science and environmental stuff. So it attracted students who had an interest in the environment, though from very many eclectic points of view. And if I think about the kids who were in that club and think about what they've gone on to do, it's amazing, really astonishing, how many of them have gone on to quite significant careers in which environment or ecology have been major parts of their intellectual and values identity. So one is now a major ecologist at Colorado State, one does history of science and is the editor of the Darwin Papers at Cambridge University, one is one of the leading energy consultants in the United States, I do environmental history, and I could go on. There are many, many people who came out of that program who really went on to significant activity in the realm of the environment. Probably the activity of Biology Honor Society that made the biggest impact on me personally, and it affected a lot of us this way, was that every spring break, the club did a major ecological field trip to some remote site where a week was spent learning ecological field research techniques. So we would run transits, we would do ordinations, we would do quadrant studies and learn how, especially plant ecologists, research the population dynamics of different plant species in a given ecosystem, so that going to Jekyll Island on the offshore of Georgia and especially the Chiricahua Mountains, which are located in the extreme southeastern corner of Arizona. There were multiple field trips that were run to the Chiricahuas, and that field trip, the trip to the Chiricahua Mountains, was a defining experience for me. I think I did that field trip with the club twice. After I graduated from high school, I actually went back and helped lead the trip as an undergraduate at UW-Madison to the Chiricahuas, and I spent a summer at the Southwestern Research Station of the American Museum of Natural History, which was our host institution for these field trips outside of Portal, Arizona. I spent a whole summer being a research assistant to ecologists that were working in the Chiricahua Mountains at that base. So it had a huge impact on me, and the Chiricahua Mountains were a big part of my identity. That word, by the way, is spelled C-H-I-R-I-C-A-H-U-A, Chiricahua. The woman who is now my wife, Nan Fay, I actually met on the very first of these Chiricahua Mountain field trips on the bus, a 36-hour bus trip that we would take from Madison south to the Chiricahua Mountains, and we happened to sit up next to each other on the bus on the drive down and began a brief romance. I was a sophomore in high school, she was a senior. We had a romance for about 3 months, then didn't see each other for 6 years. She graduated, went off to college, and then we accidentally bumped into each other just before I was headed off to Oxford and had a whirlwind romance and were married a year later. So oddly, those Biology Honor Society field trips defined my family life in an important way.
And just looking back here, do you think this group of people who came to this Biology Honor Society, and you think it was right place, right time? You think it was good teaching, interested students, appropriate curriculum?
All of the above. It was absolutely the right time, and I don't think the Biology Honor Society, I'm not even sure it still exists at Memorial High School. When I've asked about it, I haven't gotten a very clear answer, but it's very clear in the minds of the teachers that I've talked with who've since retired or moved on, that in their minds was this sort of brief moment when there was this creative ferment at Memorial High School. And of course, the historical moment was right for this kind of activity as well, because we were right on top of the first Earth Day, which is April 22nd, 1970. I would have been a sophomore, I think, in high school at the time that the first Earth Day occurred. And the first Earth Day is a very, very important event in my intellectual identity. I clearly was interested in environmental themes and historical themes well before Earth Day. And yet Earth Day was this mass, not just political, but cultural mobilization of people, all literally hundreds of thousands, millions of people across the country, around environmental themes that had a huge media buildup to it. Lots and lots of publications all over the place, all focusing on environmental questions, environmental concerns in ways that were very powerful for high school students of the right kind of bent at that moment. And so, although Biology Honor Society was absolutely not a political group, that wasn't its primary identity, it was an intellectual group and a scientific group in its focus, inevitably environmental kinds of themes and concerns and politics were always operating as a kind of subcurrent through there. So the fact that there was such a large-scale national mobilization of public concern about environmental issues in the second half of the 1960s and first half of the 1970s meant that this group of kids had all these broader national agendas circulating through their heads at the moment that they were also doing these studies of Isoides muricata and these obscure scientific things we were doing at the same time. So I would say great teacher, great institutional support, but right political moment, right demographics, right group of kids, academic brats and others from the west side of Madison, Wisconsin, all those are part of the ferment. And of course, UW-Madison was hugely involved in environmental politics and Earth Day, and the Earth Day, of course, was the creation of Gaylord Nelson, senator from Wisconsin. Madison was an epicenter of concern about those kinds of things. I remember going to hear Paul Ehrlich speak in probably 1968, 1969, whenever he spoke in the Stock Pavilion on the UW campus. And I still vividly remember certain of the things he did and said during that lecture about world population, about DDT, about various kinds of environmental problems that were part of my emerging consciousness about adult politics and adult issues and controversies in the world that I became increasingly engaged with. This, of course, is the era of Vietnam, and that too is going on, and civil rights. All those are in the background at this moment.
And I guess this may be an appropriate time to, we alluded to this, or you alluded to this in the first interview about sort of the rift that formed between yourself and your father during this time period. Was it specifically, I'm sure it was many things, but was your stance on, about the Vietnam War as opposed to your father, was that one of the issues? How did this, I guess the question is sort of how did this relationship start to fracture at this point?
Yeah, it's a really good question and a complicated and important question. I would say it's one of the benchmark crucibles of my adult life, meaning the process of coming into conflict with my father, especially over issues at Vietnam, absolutely was the epicenter, but there were other parts of it as well. This is mid to late adolescence, a time that a lot of kids go through conflicts with authority figures. Mine happened to be with my father most of all. And that rite of passage, painful though it was, and it really almost ruptured the relationship for a while, helped create me as I am, and actually the recovery from that rupture also helped create me as I am. If I were to give a quick sketch of the nature of the conflict, I would say there were at least three major sources that fed into it. One was the civil rights movement, one was the controversy over the Vietnam War, and the third one, which I think needs to be separated from the Vietnam War, though it clearly is bound up with it, is the student protests that took place on the University of Wisconsin campus. Remember, it wasn't UW-Madison until 1970-71, so I have gone back and forth between UW and UW-Madison as I've been keeping track of the chronology here. You need to know about my father that he came out of World War II as one of the World War II vets, deeply committed to certain American values that were attached to the fight against fascism during the war, attached to the idealism about remaking the United States during the 1950s that ramped up toward the civil rights movement. He's very much interested in racial equity, fairness, democracy. The integrationist agendas of the early civil rights movement were central, I'd say, to his values and his own intellectual formation. So that remarkably, his master's thesis here at the University of Wisconsin was a study of Marcus Garvey that would then, oddly, it's not common for master's thesis to be published as a separate book by the University of Wisconsin Press called Black Moses, the first biographical study that was done of Garvey, an early black separatist from the early 20th century. And strikingly, that book, which was a very, very early study in what would become African-American history, became the best-selling book of all time of the University of Wisconsin Press, which it remains to this day, which is an astonishing thing. It's still in print 50 years later and is unquestionably my father's most influential book. And it's written very much, although he's not completely sympathetic with the separatism that Garvey represents, because my father's politics were always about the 50s liberal vision of one world, one nation, human rights, all people treated fairly, equitably, and well. Those values remain central to his identity throughout. The 60s were therefore hard for my father, particularly the second half of the 60s, as the civil rights movement itself fractured into black power movements that he was far less sympathetic with than he was with the Martin Luther King vision of integration. And then, as the Vietnam War ramped up after the middle of the 1960s, after 65 or so, UW-Madison, the University of Wisconsin, then became increasingly the site of more and more confrontational encounters between increasingly radicalized students and the university power structure, which was taken by the students to represent the establishment that was fomenting this war, conducting this war that the students found increasingly objectionable. During that time, the second half of the 60s, my father was the chair of the history department. And of course, the history department was, with the political science department and some other social science and humanities departments on campus, one of the most radicalized of all the student centers on campus. And my father, as chair of the history department, therefore had often to find himself in the role of confronting students, defending the university against the protests and against what increasingly I think he saw as riots taking place on the campus. I remember at the time of the Dow Chemical protest in 1967, the history department was then located in Bascom Hall at the top of Bascom Hill, not down in the humanities building, which wasn't completed until 1971. During the Dow Chemical riots in October of 67, my father was in the building. The building was surrounded by, the students were protesting in the parking lot behind, near the Carillon, behind Bascom. My father was in the building and came upon a wastebasket that a student had left a burning fire in. And my father used a fire extinguisher and put out the burning trash can. But I think that moment became a symbol for him of what he saw as the destructiveness of these student protests. The fact that they were attacking an institution that he loved, not just the University of Wisconsin, but the academy, and the academy's search for truth and knowledge, and the academy's non-polemical role as an arbiter of fair judgment about what were disinterested claims about truth that in one of its ideals, the academy, and certainly in my father's mind, the academy stood for. I think he saw the radicalization of the students and of those protests and the increasingly violent nature of those protests as a betrayal of his core values and as a threat to the institution and values underlying that institution that were central to his adult identity. I'm quite sure that what he saw when he saw those student rioters increasingly as time went on, even though he came out of a very much a Americans for Democratic Action, ADA, liberal, democratic identity in his 1950s and early adult life, as essentially something akin to the proto-fascists that became the Nazi Party during the 1930s, so that the Nazi book burnings of the 1930s were one of the things I'm quite sure was formatively in his mind when he saw the increasingly destructive nature of some of the protests that took place in the late 60s. I give this all as historical background to my father's biography because it's critical to why our relationship came into conflict in the late 60s. My first political involvement, let's see, I would have been 10 years old at the time of the 64 presidential election. I was conscious of the Goldwater Johnson campaign. I certainly, the Kennedy assassination in 1963 is one of the very early kind of media moments and political moments that I'm acutely aware of. I know exactly where I was and what I was doing the moment I learned that John Kennedy had been shot. I think almost anybody in my generation has that knowledge in their head, as I think anybody who was alive in 2001 knows where they were when the planes flew into the Twin Towers. There are certain very small number of moments, I think of them as generation-defining moments, when an event occurs that when you hear it, you know where you were when you heard that news. There aren't many of those, but there are a few. Those two are examples. Pearl Harbor would be a defining similar one for people of my father's and mother's generation. In any event, I remember the 64 presidential campaign. One of my most vivid memories of that one is the Lyndon Johnson's ad against Barry Goldwater of the little girl plucking the mm-hmm. petals off of the daisy as the clock counts down to the nuclear bomb going off. That fits my nuclear anxieties that flow through my early childhood. The 68 campaign, though, was the first one that I actually became actively involved in because, of course, that's the Eugene McCarthy campaign. And McCarthy's anti-war presidential campaign was very inspiring, I think, to many people of my age and generation at that particular political moment. It, of course, was a short-lived movement. It had, because he was a senator from Minnesota, there was a lot of resonance in the upper Midwest, the upper Mississippi Valley, around the McCarthy campaign. And I, as a high school student, went to McCarthy rallies. They were the very first presidential rallies I had ever been to. I think I circulated leaflets. I was involved in that. And I think actually I don't honestly know where my father was on McCarthy, how sympathetic he was to McCarthy at that time. That then gave way to Bobby Kennedy's campaign, Bobby's assassination, the Humphrey Nixon campaign, Nixon's victory. The most violent of the student protests took place after that. And I think what essentially happened to my father was that he was pushed to the right during those years. That was certainly the way I experienced him. I'm not sure that that's actually a fully fair way to describe what happened to him. In a way, I think he might have said it, that he stood still, or his values remained stable, and the world shifted to the left. And so I don't know that he voted for Richard Nixon in 1972. I'm pretty sure he didn't vote for George McGovern in 1972. But it's quite possible he didn't vote in that election. And that is a token of sort of how complicated the world was becoming. I'm quite sure that the 1968 Democratic Convention was for him, again, this violent image of protesters in the streets, which was so disturbing to him as a leader of the university. All that is part of what became volatile for him. In any event, the way it expressed itself in our family dynamics was that dinner table conversations in our house from, say, 68, 69 on. Remember, I went off to college and I started UW-Madison, then UW-Madison in 1972. Stupidly, I lived at home for my first freshman year, one of the really dumb things I did as an undergraduate. So I was living in my parents' house until 73, 74, which meant that I was, in the Vietnam period, I would have been about 14 years old, say in 68, through roughly 18, 19, by the time I finally moved away from home and began living down on campus in Madison. In those years, from the time I was maybe 15 years old to the time I was 18 years old, which was the height of the Vietnam period, the dinner table conversations there was much that went on in those dinner table conversations that kept coming back over and over again to the war, to the causes of the war, to U.S. imperialism, to the causes of U.S. imperialism, how is it expressing itself in that world. And my father and I were both good debaters. My father's a very smart man. He'd been a high school debater. I was a high school debater. And so the mobilization of not just reasoned argument, logic and evidence and defense of a particular point of view, but all the rhetorical tricks that debaters also use, which are not always as honest or fair, the cheap shots, the ad hominem attacks, the things that could be used to manipulate an argument. Both of us were pretty good at both of those, and of course we were the objects of each other's rhetorical ballistics. Both of us could become red-faced, our voices would rise. My brother and my mother, and the table was set up as a circular table in our kitchen. My father and I, symbolically, I guess, sat opposite each other. My brother and my mother sat opposite each other. My mother and my brother hated these conversations. There was no way to stop them. My brother never participated in the volatile parts of these. My mother usually just tried to keep the peace, but it was very hard to keep the peace because these conversations really were very, very angry at times, at their worst. And again, at their worst, it really felt like my father and I had parted values. And the funny thing is, it's not surprising in retrospect, he and I think came to realize this, we were actually debating from the same values base, meaning my core values absolutely are recognizably my parents' values. And what was most volatile about these arguments, I think, was that one of the ways I scored points against my father was essentially, I don't know that I usually said it this way, but the implicit message was that he was betraying his own values, that he was a hypocrite relative to the things that I had been taught, and that for him to defend what were clearly unjust, unfair, illiberal, anti-democratic, you name it, go down the long list of adjectives that would be volatile in this rhetorical terrain, was a sign that the very things he had taught me and that I held dear, as both he and I held dear, were no longer things that we shared because he had betrayed the very things that he had taught me. And those were painful for both of us. There were times when we just could barely speak with each other in the wake of those conversations. And I would say there was probably a five-year period in the midst of all that where, although we continued to meet on grounds of shared interest in writing and editing, which I narrated in our last conversation, interestingly, shared interest in environmental values. My parents very much shared values about conservation and environmental protection. There's very little disagreement, actually, in our household over those issues. So notice, and this is, I think, something that was hardly limited to our family, environment was one of the places where people who were in significant conflict with each other over Vietnam or over civil rights or racial politics or riots in the cities, all those things. Environment felt like one of those places where Americans could come together with each other, no matter how they might disagree with other kinds of things. And certainly that operated in our household. So when we were off on family trips or backpacking or talking about environmental stuff, a lot of this volatility, which really epicentered on the Vietnam War, went away. So it was one of the places that we could, my father and I could meet each other and recognize that there still was this common ground between us. And we spent, I would say, much of the second half of the 1970s during my college years and then into the 1980s rebuilding our relationship and rebuilding the shared values in the relationship, which had been there all along, but that in fact had been hard to keep track of in the midst of these, remember, mid to late adolescent power struggles that were going on certainly with me in what I think Freud would clearly have recognized as an Oedipal conflict in part that was going on in this period. All this was just really volatile and really, really painful.
Was this again a matter of sort of right place, right time? I mean, you're becoming, you're moving into adolescence, young adulthood. You've got this cauldron here at UW, and to a certain extent Memorial, that just kind of meets, and I'm just thinking, you're probably not rebelling against your father this way if this was the more serene 1980s or the more serene, people say, more serene 1950s.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no question this, again, is of this particular political moment. And absolutely, Memorial High School was a hotbed of radical student politics. You'll remember I said last time that I edited a student newspaper, an underground newspaper, though it was run off on the student, on the school mimeograph machines and was fully supported by the school administration. It was an interesting underground newspaper in this context. Again, it was called Conglomerate with the first three letters capitalized. And what was odd about it, and its relevance to my struggles with my father should be evident here, was that it was not a radical left, not a radical left student newspaper. We had one of those. The student newspaper, the official student newspaper at Memorial, is still called the Sword and Shield. That was the name of it because the mascot of Memorial was then, and I think it still is, the Spartan. So Sword and Shield was the official paper. Then there was a radical underground newspaper called Behind the Shield that a group of my friends, not close friends, edited, that was full of the kind of usual underground left student anti-war stuff that was so characteristic of high school and college underground papers at that time, run off on Xerox machines or on mimeographs. Ours was a radical moderate newspaper, and that's symptomatic of me, and again is an interesting witness to the fact that my father and I were not actually that different from each other in certain our values. All of my instincts, politically and intellectually, for as far back as I can remember, and certainly right on down to now, are what I would call radical centrist politics, which is to say, I find the middle ground, the space in which you're forced to do pragmatic politics, where you're not just engaged in symbolic protest, which tends to happen the farther up toward the poles of politics you are. But also, what I love about the middle is that it's a place where you're forced to try to figure out what's going on out at the poles. And since I have always had entangled intellectual and political agendas, by which I mean my intellectual, academic, scholarly activities have lots of political relevance. I mean, when I'm doing environmental history, a lot of my scholarship has a lot of relevance to environmental politics. And yet I'm always conscious that my identity as a scholar, as a historian, as somebody who's trying to understand the world, needs to be kept distinct from, not separate from, because I don't think you can completely separate these things, but distinct from my roles as activist or polemicist or arguer on behalf of a particular ideological or activist point of view. So the center is congenial to me because it's a space in which I have to understand the left, I have to understand the right, I have to understand the full range of reasons. Well, why? How could somebody hold this conviction? Where would that conviction come from? What's the history of that conviction? What are the intellectual sources that would flow toward that conviction? And here's what seems to be an opposite conviction, and yet it seems to flow also from some similar value roots that have themselves a history that flows from that common root. I find that endlessly fascinating. And so this newspaper of radical moderation called Conglomerate that I edited during these volatile years of the late 60s and early 70s at Memorial had as its goal the fostering of dialogue among people who disagreed with each other. That was its purpose. And what I did as the editor of this newspaper, which came out every week, I think, was that I tried to get people of very different intellectual and political persuasions from the Memorial High School community, teachers, students, everybody. I tried to get them to write so that they would be brought into dialogue with each other, because I had this conviction that if we were ever to learn from each other, you had to first start talking with each other. So it was all about dialogue. And we even ran Conglomerate Symposia, where we would get people into a room, turn on a tape recorder, and record these debates. And then I would extract snippets from the debates to show what was the nature of the conversation that had happened around this controversial issue about education reform or about you name it. So the fostering of dialogue has actually been another theme that runs through my intellectual life, and is part of what I do to this day on this campus, is creating spaces in which people who might seem like they utterly disagree with each other can find a space in which they can at least recognize each other, even if they're not finally persuaded what a path forward might be that would help them find consensus or help them find ways of agreeing enough in certain zones that shared collective action could occur despite the disagreements that exist on the margins around their convictions. That became, I would say, part of my intellectual slash political project in the late 60s, early 70s, and has remained so to this day. And strikingly, these are my father's values that you hear me articulating here. So though my father and I could not have been seemingly more in disagreement, I can't believe that he didn't see in Conglomerate. I think he did. I think he was proud of Conglomerate. I think he was proud of this centrist moderating political role that I did. I mean, it was ironic, actually, that we couldn't recognize and acknowledge in each other, I in him, he in me, how much we were serving common values. But I think that's just hard in adolescence to do. I made it hard for him. I'm not sure he made it as easy on me as he could, but certainly in these relationships, I think it's the adolescent who wants to shove the things to the poles, and the parent has trouble keeping things moderate. One other thing I'll just name, because it's always kind of intrigued me about this political moment, was that obviously, one of the huge motivators of the student protests for white kids, white men, in the late 60s was the draft. And strikingly, the moment the draft went away, a lot of the energy dropped out of the anti-war movement. Not altogether, but a lot of the mass energy times pretty neatly with the removal of the draft, though obviously Nixon's reduction of forces in Vietnam is almost simultaneous with that, so it's an overdetermined event. But I am an interesting little cusp group, a demographic that I don't think historians have adequately recognized, maybe because we're such a small group, and maybe it's just me retrospectively narrating the history of my own consciousness. But I am the very last group of men to have received a draft number, a lottery number for the draft. No one after me went through the lottery. My group, my demographic, my age group did get a lottery number, but my group was never called for the draft. So the radicalizing experience that was the draft and that was that lottery for the draft, I went through it, and yet I sit right on the cusp of men who were released from that source of politicizing energy after that. It's one of the differences I've always thought between my little generation and my brother's generation. My brother has never had quite the same affinity for certain kinds of radical politics that defined my early adulthood, I would just say. I would not describe myself as radical at all now in my politics, except to the extent that the word radical means a struggle to understand ideas at their root and politics at their root, which is consistent with my centrist impulses. But I like actually to understand both the radical right and the radical left from the root, even though I've never really embraced the poles of either of those movements. The reason I mention this is that I think of myself as inhabiting a little generation of people at the very end of the student protests in the 60s who kind of point both ways politically. And what I mean by that is that my formative years as a high school student were very much caught up in the radical student politics of the 1960s. So I completely get the left. I completely understand and am sympathetic with a number of the left's impulse, critiquing power, seeking social justice, supporting grassroots activism, mobilizing people who are oppressed, trying to build a better and more just society. Those I completely sympathize with, all the claims that I just made. On the other hand, I also point in the opposite direction, which I think of as the emerging politics of the 70s and the 80s, which would become the full-blown conservative movement by the Reagan election of 1980 and the subsequent rise of the conservative political movement in the 80s and 90s, which is to say that partly because of my struggle to understand my father, and partly because I did not go through the full radicalizing experience of the draft, I guess I would say. I understand liberty. I understand suspicion of state power. I understand the abuses of government bureaucrats, of the monopolizing power that they have. I understand the ways that libertarianism actually oddly sits between the left and the right in this intellectual territory. It's an interesting part of our intellectual history in this nation, the right-left dialogue about what counts as liberty is and freedom is a really, really interesting part of what defines the United States as a nation. And again, it may be over-narrating this little group that I sit in, but I've been struck by how many people of just my age have this kind of bipolar, ambivalent relationship toward the left and right, such that we can't fully embrace either of the poles. We sit in this ambiguous center in a way that is often frustrating to people whose polar politics are clearer to them than they are, at least to me. And that operates for people who moved very far right in the 1980s. I can't go there. But the people who moved very far left in the 1960s and have never really left that pole, I can't go there either. I sit in this strange, ambivalent middle ground, which enables me to have, I think it makes me a better historian. And being a good historian has always been one of my primary intellectual drivers. It is a driving concern of mine, which I think is the fundamental impulse of history. I want to understand things. My first obligation is to understand. I also believe that it's an obligation that the search for understanding that academics and scholars love does not let us off the hook from acting. We have also to act. But the act of understanding and the act of doing in the world need to be conducted in parallel with each other. We need them both. Neither one should trump the other. Neither one should fully contaminate the other, meaning even when one is acting, one shouldn't put one's understanding purely at the polemical service of one's action. The goal of understanding is not just to justify action, it's to criticize action and understand at the same time. It's very complicated.
I think I'd be remiss at this point if I didn't ask about one specific event. You mentioned the Dow riots of 67. But what your memories or thoughts were about Sterling Hall.
Yeah, Sterling Hall was another pivotal moment. I said that the end of the draft was one of the things that knocked the wind out of the sails of the anti-war movement. Another on this campus, and I think to some extent elsewhere as well, but certainly vividly on this campus, was the bombing of Sterling Hall in, what was it, May of 1970? Was it 71?
I think it was 70. It might have been August.
I think you're right. It was August. I was not in town for that event. My parents owned a small piece of rural land out at the end of Mineral Point Road on Highway 78 out there. And I spent a fair amount of time out on that land during these years, just hiking and doing natural history kind of stuff out there. And I was actually camping out, I think, on that land the night of the Sterling Hall bombing. But it was a huge event, obviously, and my parents' house, which is 5 miles from campus, 4 or 5 miles, they were awakened in the middle of the night by that explosion, which tells you something about just how loud it was that you could be awakened 4 or 5 miles away from it. And that was an experience of many, many people who were in town on that. And it was obviously a devastating event. And the fact that a graduate student died, Robert Fasconac, I still almost remember his name, was I think appalling to many people. I'm sure in my father's mind it was a confirmation of all that was most awful and most proto-fascist like about this anti-war movement. But I think even people who are fully committed to the anti-war movement reacted to the bombing frequently by saying, this is not what this was supposed to be about. This is the opposite of what this was supposed to be about. Peace. It was supposed to be about nonviolence, not about violence. It wasn't about killing people. And the double irony of that was for people who understood what was being bombed. It was the Army Math Research Center that was the object of that bombing. But of course, the trouble with mathematics as an activity is that it's a bunch of smart minds in front of blackboards, at least then it was. The computer was less important. So the idea that you would blow up the physics department because in one little corner of Sterling Hall were a bunch of offices of mathematicians with blackboards, where you weren't actually affecting the activity at all, even if you thought that that activity was fully serving the war, and it's not obvious at all that the Army Math Research Center was really doing that. It seemed really kind of dumb, seemed really kind of insane that millions of dollars of damage was done to the hardware of a physics department that had nothing whatsoever to do with the war effort in the targeting of these blackboards. That's one way of interpreting it, though I'm sure people that here again, you're hearing an interpretation from the center when I say that, and an expression of my own ironic ambivalent politics. Even to hear me narrate it that way is evidence of the point of view that I was describing earlier. But I would say that although the protests certainly didn't end, they became, I think, much more half-hearted from that point on. And a lot of the people who were more centrist in their tendencies began to fall away from the more radical strands of the student protests in the wake of that bombing. I certainly think of it as a description of me. I became a good deal less enthusiastic about the intensity of the protests from that point on. Notice, though, that this is also 1970 and it's Earth Day, so there is now this environmental counterweight, and an increasing amount of my political energy from this point forward are directed toward environmental kinds of interests and concerns. The war is ramping down, and is becoming a less and less important focus. We're headed toward the energy crisis of the 1970s. That would be a big part of my formative intellectual experience as an undergraduate. I would go on at the end of my undergraduate years at UW-Madison to give the honors convocation address my graduating year in 1976, that was a talk actually about the energy crisis and the political and moral issues of the energy crisis that would then lead to the doctoral dissertation that I would write at Oxford University on energy consumption. So energy as a focus of environmental politics in the 1970s, after the 73 war, would be a growing part of where my intellectual and political energies would be focused from that point on.
And I think there's some other things I could ask about your time at Memorial, but I think in terms of moving the narrative forward and making sure we hit what we want to hit today, I'll ask this simple question that I may know the answer to, but I won't if I don't ask it. Why matriculate at UW?
Well, it's an interesting question. Part of the answer about why I chose to go to UW-Madison was that I didn't think very hard about it. It was a very different era in those days, I would say. At least in my family, none of the intense focus on where a kid is going to go to college and this extreme competition that now takes place among high ability high school kids to get into the top schools, all of that. I was surrounded at Memorial by really smart kids, the academic brats, high IQ, high achieving, overachieving kids. An amazing group of high school friends who actually would go on to be my closest UW-Madison friends. And the fact that so many of my high-ability Memorial High School peers went to UW-Madison, and some of them became my roommates on campus in the apartment that we owned that we rented on Bassett Street, is a token of UW-Madison's recruiting that kind of kid during that period. The true answer is I applied only to UW-Madison. I didn't really even think about applying to anywhere else. I think it was partly because I had already done all that cave-related research in the Wisconsin Historical Society. I didn't know at that time that I was going to be a historian. That decision didn't get made till the very end of my high school, of my college years at UW-Madison. But I knew the campus really well. I spent a lot of time on campus. There was nothing I really didn't like about it. I knew the libraries. I had lots of relationships that were on campus. My father was a professor, and that wasn't a plus in the sense that I didn't want to be known on campus as my father's son, but I didn't really worry much about that. Had I known that he was about to become the dean of the College of Letters and Science, which he became, I think, in my sophomore year of college, I don't know that I would have made the same choice, because being the son of the dean was a much bigger thing than being the son of a history professor on the campus. There's a little bit more to it, though. My father had persuaded me over the years in by osmosis that UW-Madison was one of the great universities of the world, that one could get an absolutely superb education at UW-Madison, and it was unbelievably cheap. So the tuition when I entered, I think, was about $250 a semester. I lived at home, remember, in my first year, so there was no cost of living on top of that. And my parents had told us all along that they would pay for college, that was something that they were committed to doing. But I honestly think part of me was thinking, well, how could I justify spending thousands of dollars on tuition and living expenses when for $250 a semester I could have a first-rate college education in my hometown in a place that I loved, a place that I knew, it just didn't, and where a lot of my friends were going, what was there not to like about that? Subsequently, knowing what I now know about the larger landscape of higher education and having spent 15 years at Yale, I now see the consequences of the choices and the things that I became most strikingly aware of when I won a Rhodes Scholarship and went off to Oxford. I became very, very conscious in the opening months of my time surrounded by Rhodes Scholars at Oxford by what my peers at Oxford had gotten from their college educations that I felt like I hadn't gotten from my college education. So there was a period in there when I really wondered whether I had made a significant mistake in having made the choice that I did. That said, I've never regretted going to the University of Wisconsin. I got an absolutely brilliant education here, which I don't honestly think I could have gotten anywhere else. And probably I should let our narrative, as we proceed now into my college years, explain why I hold that view. And talking about some of the teachers who most influenced me at UW-Madison and the activities that I did here that were so central to who I then became and the way I now live my adult life. I'm immensely grateful for what I've gotten from this place. And the fact that I came back here as a tenured professor from Yale, that I would leave Yale and come back here, is a token of how much I cherish the values and the qualities of this institution that in my mind are not unique, but very special indeed, and really deeply admirable in ways that are worth defending and supporting. But the quick answer to the question is I didn't think very much about it. I applied to only one place. It seemed cheap, and it seemed like it was great value for money. I guess the last thing I would say, my parents would disagree with this, that it's one that we've never ceded to each other. We return to it every so often. I think actually it was, my father would say that he made it clear to me I could go anywhere I wanted. But I think in my own mind, I had the feeling, because of the way my father talked about the University of Wisconsin, that he would be really proud if I came to the University of Wisconsin, because it was an institution he cared so much about. And it wasn't that I would be betraying him if I went somewhere else. It absolutely never took that form, and certainly he never guilt-tripped me in that way. It worked in the opposite direction. It was a positive value statement rather than a passive-aggressive emotional manipulation statement that I'm sure this is true, that my dad was not at all unhappy, not remotely unhappy, that I chose to come to the University of Wisconsin, to his institution, to an institution he cared so much about. He was very proud of that, proud of how well I did as an undergraduate at the University of Wisconsin. And I think I was proud to earn his pride in that territory. I think part of me knew in a very subtle way that, again, my father would deny it, what I've just said. I think I knew that he would be proud that if I chose to come to the University of Wisconsin. And I was, part of me, despite all of our conflict in that period, wanted his pride in that.
Yeah, I was just, and this may be more of a comment than a question, it would seem that, you know, the general adolescent angst fueled by massive debates over Vietnam, that if, you know, you were thinking that your father wanted you to go here, then you would pick
the farthest possible way.
You know, you'd draw a circle around the country and find the place that was farthest away from here.
But it didn't work that way. I can't really say why it didn't work that way, but it just, that was not a thought. And I think this may now be a token of my arrogance in the Oedipal conflict territory. You asked a question in the last interview that's sort of relevant to this. It's not that I thought I was beating my father, but I think I was self-confident enough, despite all the anxieties that also drive me, to think I could be my own man, that I could be my own person, and that my achievements were not just achievements of my father's son, meaning I wasn't doing what I was doing, I wasn't accomplishing what I was accomplishing, because my father was helping me do it. I was confident enough of what I was doing that I was doing it because I wanted to do it, because I cared about it, because I believed in it. And therefore, I didn't feel like in going to Wisconsin, I was going to his school because he wanted me to come to school, despite what I just said about his pride. It's much subtler and more complicated than that. It wasn't about one of us overshadowing the other.
Okay, sort of a general comment again, question to start the narrative about your time specifically here at UW. You mentioned this in your previous answer, but I'm always curious into when you're in this sort of formative period, who are your mentors here? And so maybe thinking about mentors, thinking about your path here as you go from whatever you thought you were going to be to what you became.
Yeah, maybe I can narrate that most efficiently for you. There's really one mentor by far who is the most important, other than my father, obviously. And what's interesting is that despite the conflict I've narrated for you, I always went to my father, really right up until his death last year. Whenever I was facing a major choice, whenever I was trying to figure out what my major should be, or figuring out a difficult question about my career, and it took many, many different forms, I would almost always ask my father about it. I would almost always seek his counsel, not because I wanted him to tell me what to do, but because he was just a really thoughtful guy who had really subtle, practical thoughts about relevant considerations for making choices. That's the way I would probably put it. So my father remained a mentor, curiously, all through this, even at the moments of deepest conflict between us. And that, again, was one of the places we most reliably met each other was in the realm of pragmatic politics, by which I mean not ideological politics, but the politics of getting things done in the world. My father was really good at how to get things done in the world, and much of my skill in that territory is directly derived from my dad. So I give that all as background. Remember, I'm at UW-Madison. I see my father and my parents whenever I need to see them. So he's in this mix. He's in this dialogue all along, though, of course, I never took a course from him. So one way to efficiently answer the question, I had one significant mentor. I went through a long peregrination of majors on this campus. I entered college because of the Biology Honor Society and because of the junior biology research seminar that I narrated earlier that Leroy Lee taught, thinking I was going to be a quantitative plant ecologist based on the work I'd done on the pre-settlement vegetation of Sauk County as a junior, senior in high school. I thought for a while, geology was one of my long loves because of the soft rock geology sedimentary work I had done on Wisconsin caves. So I took geology from the moment I arrived and could easily have become an earth science geology major of one kind or another. But remember, I had known for a very long time and self-consciously since eighth grade that I wanted to be a writer more than I wanted to be anything at all. And I actually, for a while in college, thought I wanted to be a novelist. So it was obvious to me from the beginning that I was going to be an English major. But it was also pretty obvious I was going to be something else too. I was going to be an English major plus something. And there was a, I'm, now I'm being a little muddled in the way that I narrate the sequence of this, to finish off on the novelist one for a second. In my freshman year, I went to work for the university bookstore. And that actually, in fact, I might have even started that in high school. I might have started that in my senior year of high school. And I had that as a job all through college. So I was actually the buyback person. I did the buying back of used textbooks with a couple of other people who I still know and still keep in touch. It's a very intense place to work. And given how bookish I am and how much I love books, I have maybe 35,000 books in my personal library stacked in my basement. That collecting impulse, which again is an echo of my father, it began at the university bookstore and has never ceased in a way. That's relevant because I actually dropped out of UW-Madison at the beginning of my sophomore year of college to write a novel. My parents' deal was that they would support me through college, but that if I weren't in school, I had to fully support myself. So I worked full-time at the university bookstore, was going to be for the whole of my sophomore year to write a novel. It was so exhausting working 40 plus hours a week in a minimum wage job while trying to write at the same time that I only lasted a semester doing that and then came back. And that was actually a defining moment of deciding that I didn't actually want to be a freelance writer. I didn't want to have to support myself just by writing. Just felt too hard. Felt like I couldn't have many other things in my life that I cared about. So actually that experience of dropping out or taking a leave of absence for a semester was what persuaded me that I actually wanted to be an academic. That I am utterly a child of the university. I've been in universities all my life. I love the academy. I love the life of the mind. I love the unbelievable array of disciplinary perspectives that are in these places. I couldn't imagine somebody like me existing anywhere else in some ways. This is my natural environment intellectually to be in it. So the dilemma from the middle of my sophomore year forward was, all right, I'm going to probably be a university professor. What kind of a university professor should I be? And I will backtrack a little bit I already said I'm going to be an English major because I thought that being an English major was a way to support my being a writer, meaning intellectually to support my being. I'd read lots of things that writers write by being an English professor, though I rapidly became persuaded that English professors didn't actually write fiction, didn't write the kind of things that I wanted to write. They wrote about writing, and I wanted to write. So pretty early on, actually, I figured out that being an English professor was not what I wanted to be. So what happened, this sort of key moment in my undergraduate career, on my father's advice, another one of these occasions where I went to my dad and said, well, what should I take? And I often asked him this, so what are some good courses that you know, who are some faculty members that I'd take a course with? And I don't know why he recommended this, but he said he had heard good things about a guy teaching in the English department and the Scandinavian Studies department, and Richard Ringler, Dick Ringler, and maybe I should take a course with him. And I don't think my father knew Ringler, certainly didn't know him well. Ringler was himself a Wisconsin kid who was actually the son of the editor or the publisher of the Milwaukee Journal, had grown up in Milwaukee, had gone to Harvard, had been a Spencer Scholar at Harvard, had done a dissertation at Harvard on this very queen, but that had come back to UW-Madison and had developed a growing interest in early English literature, very early English literature, back to Beowulf. And Dick had begun to develop, and I think I was one of the first people to take it. I think he probably taught it once or twice, an honors English seminar, an honors course, English 360, called The Anglo-Saxons, which was still in my mind. I took it the second semester of my freshman year on my father's advice. A transformative moment. It was one of the most brilliant classroom performances I have ever seen, if not the most brilliant classroom performance I have ever seen. What was it that was so astonishing about Dick Ringler as a teacher? For one thing, interestingly, he taught almost entirely with slides. So the medium that was already congenial to me as a photographer and as a visual/narrative storyteller was the way Dick organized his classes, which is to say he would come in with his slide projector, set it up, and then would put on the screen images of the things that he was going to talk about. And the second thing that was so astonishing about Ringler's classroom was that although he was an English professor, I think of him and I think of what he taught as profoundly cultural intellectual history in the richest possible sense of those phrases, by which I mean there was nothing that wasn't fair game for Dick Ringler's mill. there was nothing he couldn't haul into that course and somehow connect with everything else we've been thinking about or looking at in ways that you never in a million years would have expected, that these things could all be in the same course. And yet he would just haul this seemingly random stuff into the space of that classroom and show how it was the world. It was all the world. And as I've tried to, over the years, explain what was so powerful for me about that course, I think of it as a microcosm, macrocosm thing. My best metaphor for it is a kaleidoscope, in which it wasn't that Dick was as much a storyteller as I am, which is to say, I'm very fond of linearly plotted narrative sequences in which a series of episodes build toward a climactic event and a denouement. That narrative shape, that Aristotelian narrative shape, is the way my mind organizes the world. That's not really the way Dick's mind organizes the world. Instead, what he does, what is so astonishing to watch him do what he does, he still does it. I, whenever he gives a lecture, I still try to go out of my way to hear it if I possibly can. What he does is take a fragment of the world, a little piece of a kaleidoscope, and weaves around that fragment the skein of patterns that finally form that unbelievably complicated, intricate set of patterns, which are the rotating set of geometries that happen when you turn the kaleidoscope. And what's brilliant about the way he does it is that no matter which of the fragments you pick, you can show the underlying patterns if you were clever enough to connect enough stuff outward from that central point. So that, for instance, we might devote one lecture to 17 lines of a fragment of a poem that exists in only one copy in an ancient 12th century medieval manuscript from Anglo-Saxon England. The survivals of the Anglo-Saxon poetry are from later manuscripts, which is why my dates are set up the way they were on that. And then the next week, the next lecture, we might look at that, the vellum on which those lines were written, and he would talk about how vellum was manufactured in the monasteries at that time by killing the sheep, scraping the inner side of the internal part, removing the hair from one side, the wool from one side of the skin, and the innards from the other side, which is why, and I still remember this, why writing on vellum, the two sides of a sheet of vellum, is different, because in one case you're writing on the outside of the animal, on the other side where all the hair was, and on the other side you're writing on the inside of the animal, and your pen works differently on that. Now who knew? That's a pretty eccentric little piece of information. But it's astonishing. It just shows. And then so it also means vellum is extremely expensive because you've got to kill a whole animal for a few sheets of this stuff. And that means that it's so precious that you never throw it out. And so you've written one manuscript on it, but you decide you no longer need that manuscript. You don't throw out the vellum. What you do is you take a knife and you scrape off all the ink that you can on one side and then write a new manuscript on top of the vellum that you've scraped off of the old. But that means that there's still an artifact, tracings of that old set of letters that are underneath that you've scraped off, which is why there are whole manuscripts from the medieval period that exist only as what are called palimpsests, one of my very favorite words in the English language. Palimpsests are those ghost manuscripts that have been scraped away and had another manuscript written on top of them. But if you examine the vellum with an x-ray or with the right kind of optics, you can try to make out the text that was written underneath the first time. Anyway, Ringler's class was full of that kind of stuff. Very, very evocative for me. And of course, remember, I was a Tolkien freak. I was a Lord of the Rings kid. And J.R.R. Tolkien was one of the great Anglo-Saxonists of the first half of the 20th century, great translator of Beowulf, wrote a famous essay on Beowulf and the critics. And I knew that, and I knew how much, because I was a serious Lord of the Rings person, meaning I was one of the people who read the appendix. I was one of the people who knew enough about that work to have at least an inkling of the extent to which the Lord of the Rings is an expression of Tolkien's rich engagement with Anglo-Saxon and Old Norse and Old Irish literatures, and that if you really want to understand the complexity of the Lord of the Rings, you have to begin to burrow down into those literatures and the linguistics of those literatures to fully appreciate them. And of course, Ringler was teaching a course on the Anglo-Saxons. It wasn't a course on the Lord of the Rings. But he knew, you've asked now a couple times about right place, right time, the Ballantine edition of Lord of the Rings had come out in the late 60s. I had read it long before that paperback edition came out. But the world was full of kids who were being enraptured by the Lord of the Rings, and who had been prepared to have a new appreciation for Anglo-Saxon England because of the influence of that work. So Tolkien was around the margins of that course in complicated ways. A couple of last things I'll say about Ringler was that it's not just right time, right place, as you framed the question earlier. It's right people for each other. Ringler, in many ways, is an eccentric human being, as I am a deeply eccentric human being. And I think we were examples of a student and a teacher finding each other and meeting in a common intellectual territory and falling in love. I certainly fell in love with him, not in any erotic sense of that word, but his mind, the richness of his mind, the subtlety with which he could ask questions, his ability to trace out patterns, I just found breathtaking. And I was obviously a smart, intensely engaged kid, that having now been a teacher myself for a quarter century and more, it's a great gift to a teacher to be given a student who is in love with what you're teaching, and who is just eager to soak it all up and learn and know more and more. I think by the time I was done, I had taken three courses maybe from Ringler, but more importantly, I was in dialogue with Ringler for the rest of my undergraduate career, meaning I would go in and talk with him in his office. I'd ask him endless questions. I engaged him in many, many different ways. And I'll be forever grateful for this. One of the differences, I would say, between the culture of University of Wisconsin and the culture of a place like Yale, this is one of the things that when I left Wisconsin and met all those terrifying Rhodes Scholars and kids at Oxford, I felt initially like I hadn't gotten a great education here. It's normative at many other elite colleges that there is a fairly intense interaction between teachers and students of a sort that is, I think, much less common in big state universities, because it's much easier for kids to go through these large places and not have very many intense personal relationships, because I was my father's son, because I was an academic brat, because I was willing to talk with professors. I actually had many relationships with teachers, and because they didn't have many kids like me, I actually think I got more of their attention and more intense engagement from them than even if I'd gone to an Ivy League school. I think that is probably the case. But from no one did I get more of that than I got from Ringler, which is to say, the respect with which he engaged me, meaning he was one of those people for whom there were no stupid questions. In fact, there were only really smart, interesting questions. And no matter what the dumb, ignorant question you brought to him with, he had a way of conveying to you that that was a really exciting question, and that we need to spend 15 minutes, 30 minutes trying to figure it out. And so we would sit in his office and just talk about this question. And the seriousness and with respect with which he engaged these sophomoric questions that I was asking was, for me, again, a really intense experience of what really great teaching should be. In so many ways, I try to emulate in my own life and career the qualities of respect, openness, genuine relationship that I think of Dick enacting in those long ago dialogues with me, that I'll just be forever, forever grateful to him for that. One last thing, there are two moments that I still vividly remember from my interactions with Ringler. There was one day, the Anglo-Saxon class that I took with him met, I think, in mid-afternoon. And one day at around 1 o'clock or 1:30, I went up to his office in Scandinavian Studies on Van Hise to ask him a question. And I knocked on the door, which was ajar, and I walked into the room, and he was sitting there with his slide projector on, projecting against a sheet of paper in his office, and he was delivering his lecture. It was an hour before the lecture, and he was delivering the entire lecture in his office. And this was a really important moment for me, because his lectures themselves felt like he was making them up on the spot. He had a little stack of note cards, and he would start talking, and what was most unusual about his mind, and I've never been able to emulate this, this is not the way I work, was the way he seemed to get where he was going by moving sideways he never seemed to, he would start in one direction and then he would say, oh, digression. And that would be the signal that he was about to take a side path. And more often than not, we never got off of the side path. The side path would lead to another side path, and that would lead to another side path. And we'd be tracking around this kaleidoscope, and we would still get the pattern, but it would feel like it was kind of invented in the moment. It was kind of like he was thinking out loud. And I think he genuinely did do that when I say he was in that office giving that lecture. I don't think it meant that it was all scripted, because I do think that his mind did do these sideways moves. It was one of the things that was so wonderful about him as a teacher. But the lesson for me was, here's this guy who gives these brilliant lectures that just seem to flow off of him with no work at all. It's like he's just making it up as it goes along. And here he is in this office, delivering the entire lecture so that it's a genuinely richly polished performance by the time he does that. And that to me was, whoa, there's more work going on here than there looks to be. And it became a practice of mine. And still to this day, it's not that I deliver every lecture I give ahead of time. I did that actually prior to the first 5-8 years of my teaching practice. I literally delivered every lecture in my office before I gave it. I now spend that hour not actually speaking the lecture, because I now know I trust myself to live in the oral space of the lecture more than I did at the beginning of my career. But I don't ever give a lecture without fully in my mind working through the entire sequence and knowing exactly what the moves are going to be to do it. One last Ringler point, and then you can redirect me. The other moment that for me was a revelatory moment with this incredibly smart, learned man. I walked into his office one day and I asked a really, what I thought was a really simple question, meaning I walked in, sat down, I'm not even sure I sat down because I thought it was just, I don't remember what the question was, but I remember thinking it was an information question, meaning I just wanted some information from him. So I stopped by his office and I asked this information question. And he paused, and he is still a man who thinks hard, meaning, again, a lesson is, he's not a person who does things off the top of his head. He mulls them before he listens, he reflects before he speaks. And this trivial question, he paused and looked at the wall. And the look went on for like 30 seconds. It was a much longer pause than I was expecting from what I thought was a really simple question. And then he said, I don't know. And that was a revelation. This really learned, smart man, in the face of what seemed to me to be a trivial question, didn't know the answer. And he said he didn't know the answer. He didn't make it up. He didn't pretend to know it. He declared his ignorance of the question. And that to me was a really important lesson, that it was okay to say you don't know something, even when you're an expert, even when you are a learned man. But then, of course, we had a half hour conversation about this thing he didn't know, because the lesson then became, all right, well, maybe we can figure this out. And so we sat there for half an hour trying to figure it out. And we did it together, brainstorming, looking up things in the library that was his bookshelf, just trying to chew on it to figure out what a way forward on that question might look like, even though neither one of us knew what the answer was. That was a really powerful moment of dialogue with him. So to terminate this, because I know I'm going on longer about this than you would want, though this was really the defining experience of my middle years as an undergraduate. By the end of my second semester of freshman year, I was increasingly thinking I would be a medieval studies major, following in Dick Ringler's footsteps. And I actually designed an independent major and got the university to approve this independent major that would involve engaging the early Middle Ages. I took Old Norse from Dick Ringler. I took Old English from Dick Ringler. I actually even took a semester of Old Irish, God help me, one of the nightmare languages of the human experience. Very, very complicated, difficult language. And I thought I was going to be a medievalist. I actually won the Rhodes Scholarship to Oxford to do the early course at Oxford, which is the early medieval, essentially Beowulf to Chaucer phase of the Middle Ages. Thought I was going to go to the University of Toronto, which at that time was one of the best centers for medieval studies in the United States, in North America, rather. And until my senior year, that was the path I was on, and was the center of my intellectual project from late freshman through the end of my junior year. And that now brings us to a turning point that would completely remove me from that path and move me in opposite direction. But you may want to ask a question or two about the stuff I've been throwing at you.
You know, I do.
How much time do you have?
But we're at one, we're at an hour and 20 minutes.
So you've got 20 minutes left?
Yeah.
We've got time.
Okay.
You want to end now, or you?
I could hit a couple of follow-ups here, but I think it would be good to hit the turning point.
Okay.
If we can do the turning point.
Okay.
Then I think that gets us to Oxford, where we want to start
next
interview
time.
Number three with
okay.
bringing up the environmental.
That's fine.
All right.
So I'll do the turning point, and then you, if you want to do a calibrating question, you can.
Okay.
There were two transitions that took me away from the Middle Ages. One was that I'm not quite sure how I made the decision not to do an independent major in medieval studies. That may have been as late as my fall of my senior year. I was in the honors program, and because I was doing a double major, I still was doing the English major. I knew that I wanted to do a senior thesis as the capstone of my honors. And remember, because I wanted to be a writer still, but because I was being an academic now, I wanted to do a senior thesis that was as close to a novel as I could get that would still be a legitimate work of academic scholarship. And it seemed to me that the closest literary form I could think of that was like a novel but that was scholarly academic would be to do a biography. So I decided that I was going to do a biography, and I began to cast about for someone I could write about as an undergraduate that I could do a full-scale literary biography of. Dream no small dreams. And I also, I don't know how I happened on it. Well, I do know the source. I ended up writing for my senior thesis, though I never actually finished it. I never actually submitted it. It's something I probably shouldn't confess. A biography of a California poet by the name of Robinson Jeffers, whose work I first encountered in one of the Sierra Club exhibit formats books that David Brower edited in the 1960s that ultimately led to his removal as the head of the Sierra Club. A book called Not Man Apart, which had an introduction by Lauren Isley, who for an extended period, 5 years, was the most influential writer on me as a science/nature writer during my junior high and high school years. There was a period when if you'd read my prose, you'd have thought this is somebody struggling to look like Lauren Isley or sound like Lauren Isley. But Not Man Apart was a collection of Robinson Jeffers' poetry set against the beautiful photography of the Big Sur coastline, which is where his poetry was set. The photographs illustrated what the poetry was talking about. So it was very evocative, very powerful nature poetry. That was the way I understood it. So I thought, well, nobody's written a biography of Robinson Jeffers. Maybe I can write a biography of Robinson Jeffers. And I won't narrate that story at great length. I won a Knapp scholarship from the Honors Program to actually go to California and to Texas, where the Jeffers papers were located, and spend the entire summer doing archival research for this. It was a very tightly organized collection. I did a huge amount of research for this project, hundreds and hundreds of pages of notes that went into it. I bought a VW bug, drove to California, slept in Robinson Jeffers' bed in the house in Carmel that he built for himself, met the family, did an oral interview history with the family that was one of the more bizarre oral history conversations I've ever had. After we turn off the tape recorder, I can tell you what was bizarre about it. And then went to Texas, came down with pneumonia, was in the hospital for a week. It was a great adventure in scholarship, strikingly, importantly, for the turning point of this narrative that I'm sharing with you. I loved the experience of writing about 20th century America. And I was becoming increasingly worried about the Middle Ages that I would find them claustrophobic. A seductive attraction of the Middle Ages, especially the early Middle Ages, that somebody like Ringler stood for in my mind, is that unlike modernity, it is almost literally possible to read every scrap of written documentation that has come down to us from the early Middle Ages. Literally, there's not that much of it. There's so little of it that you can read it all, and you can spend your lifetime trying to figure out what these fragments mean. That's, of course, what was so powerful about that kaleidoscope that Ringler was showing me in that classroom. But I was worried that there wouldn't be enough new stuff because I'm kind of easily bored. One of my attributes as intellectuals, I'm always moving on to something else. I'm always shifting, making quite radical shifts from one topic that I work intensely for a while, and then I move to another topic. And I was just worried that I wouldn't be able to be happy in that tight little world of the fragments that had come down from the early Middle Ages. And writing the Jeffers biography, which finally got to 450 pages before I petered out, huge. And not only got it to age 30, this guy that lives to his mid-70s, I got him to age 30 and wrote 450 pages about him as an undergraduate. It was a great experience. I loved the writing of that biography. And it persuaded me that the modern period was just more, had more space for me in it. The other big thing that happened, again on my father's advice, to go back to that theme, I went to my dad early in my senior year and said, what should I think about taking? And he said, well, you might like the history of the American West. Al Bogue is teaching his Western history course. Maybe you should take that. I wouldn't have taken it if my father hadn't said that. So I walk into that course. And that became another revelation for me. Bogue was much less important to me as a mentor than Ringler. Ringler and my father are, without question, of my college and pre-college career, the two most important mentors I had. Howard Lamar at Yale would become a third. But what Bogue did in his course, he taught the history of the American West as a frontier history course, and he organized the course rather oddly. It was a two-semester course divided into six-week blocks, and each of the 6 weeks did the entire sweep of the time that he was covering. So he kept resetting the clock every 6 weeks and going back and doing a new theme. So for instance, one six-week block was American Indian history in the West. One of his blocks was the history of the public lands and of conservation. So the history of the land and of the federal lands. And it was environmental history at a time when environmental history didn't exist. And it was like, whoa, you can do this in American history? You can do Ringler's kaleidoscope, you can do natural history, you can do ecology and geology, you can do history, you can do writing. This is, of course, Jeffers. The Jeffers biography was, he's an environmental poet, right? I can do all the things I love in this space called the history of the American West. There isn't yet something called environmental history, but there seems to be an awful lot of land and environment in this Western history stuff. This is what I should do. And by the end of my first semester of my senior year, I was increasingly persuaded that this looked like what I wanted to do. There was a problem, though. I had applied by accident. September of my senior year, I went into the honors program. Chet Rudicilli was then the head of the honors program. And I think it must have been the second week of classes, and he said, oh, Bill, have you thought about applying for a Rhodes Scholarship? And I said, what's that? I'd never heard of a Rhodes Scholarship. And he explained what it was, 2 years of study at Oxford, and you know, you write a 1,000-word essay about what you're interested in, you turn in your list of activities, and he said, you know, you might just be a competitor for this, then you should apply. So in a week, I put together a Rhodes Scholarship application, which, notice, this is the beginning of my senior year, right, was for me to study early medieval literature and languages at Oxford University in the early English course. Long story short, the competition for the Rhodes involves interviews that take place then. They took place in the first week of December. I went through the interview process. I was selected by the state of Wisconsin as a regional candidate. I went to Chicago and was awarded a Rhodes Scholarship first week of December of my senior year, at a moment that I was pretty much sure I no longer wanted to do the Middle Ages. So I felt like I had gotten a Rhodes Scholarship under fraudulent circumstances. And I, as this decision about doing the West became clearer and clearer as I moved into second semester, I began to feel more and more guilty about what I had told Oxford I was going to do, and I felt like I should give the scholarship back that I wanted under false pretenses. And finally, late in my second semester, I wrote this anguished letter to the warden at Rhodes House, saying, at the time when we were selecting colleges and course of study, saying, you know, I said in the application I was going to do early Middle Ages, but I really should just do the modern history degree. And I feel badly. If you want to take the scholarship away, I certainly understand. And he, Brit that he was, and the English are not big on wearing their hearts on their sleeves and do not reveal private things about themselves as nearly as quickly as Americans do. I know, because he later said, what's this guff that you're spilling out on the page? It's a waste of time. Just change your course and don't bleed on the paper about it. So I wrote Oxford and said, wrote my college at Oxford and said, I'll do the modern history BA, the second BA in modern history, just to get the whole sweep of history. By this time, I decided to be a history major in addition to English. So that also happened. Because I'd taken enough history courses, I was able actually to do the history major just in my senior year. And so I was going to do the second degree in history, a baccalaureate, and then I would come back to the United States and get a PhD in the history of the American West. The quick to bring this story quickly to a close, we'll talk next time, I think, about my experience at Oxford. But I was asked to give the honors convocation address, I've already mentioned this, in May of my senior year, delivered in the shell over by Camp Randall to an audience of maybe 1,000 graduating seniors and their families. And because this is the energy crisis, right, one of my political concerns is energy, I gave a speech called Of Food and Other Things about the energy crisis and its moral implications for our lives as graduating seniors. It was a powerful and risky address, meaning I made some moves in it rhetorically that were just on the edge of being inappropriate, not crossing that line, but right up against the line. But it was one of the more powerful speeches I've written in my life, and I don't mean that as self-praise, meaning it was a very ambitious speech. It gathered an awful lot of stuff, and I still remember I went and saw Ed Young, the chancellor at that time, and asked what I should do. He said, well, whatever you do, don't give him a great message. Just do something small, which is where the title Of Food and Other Things came from. But it was a very ambitious big message I was giving them. And it was about the energy crisis. And the reason why this is relevant was that I had written Oxford saying I wanted to do the BA. And right at the time that I wrote this speech, I got a letter from my moral tutor at Jesus College, which is essentially your advisor at Jesus College, which is the college to which I'd been assigned at Oxford, from a guy named John Walsh, lovely man, scholar of dissenting Protestant traditions in 18th century and 19th century England. Who said, you know, you've done a lot of research as an undergraduate, and an awful lot of American students come to Oxford and they just don't like the second BA because they don't know enough. They just don't know enough English history to feel like that they're not behind. I still remember his metaphor. He said they've experienced the Oxford history curriculum as going down a very slick marble hallway on roller skates without being able to touch the walls. And you're somebody who clearly has burrowed deep into a topic, so why don't you just do a B.Lit degree, which is a thesis degree, where you come here for 2 years, you write a thesis, you don't take any courses, clearly you know how to do that, you'd probably enjoy that more and get more out of it. So he said the only problem is if you decide you want to do this, and I was persuaded by his arguments against the BA that I probably did want to do it, you need to come up with a thesis topic in the next week and get it to me to be approved by the faculty if you're going to do this degree. All right. Come up with a thesis topic in a week, but of course I was giving a speech about energy, so I thought, well, maybe. Wouldn't it be interesting? Most of my projects begin with that phrase. Wouldn't it be interesting? Wouldn't it be interesting to write a history of an English town looking at its energy supply over a long time to see how energy is entangled with people's social and economic lives? Wouldn't that be interesting? I wonder if that's possible. And David Ward was then a historical geographer in this department. I don't remember where his office was, but it might well have been one of these. And I'd never taken a course from David, but I went to him on my father's advice, yet again, and said, would it be possible to do a master's thesis, a B.Lit thesis at Oxford on energy consumption in English town? Would the documents exist to do that? And if so, do you have any ideas about what town I might pick? And David, to his great credit, who of course worked on British and American cities in the 19th century, so this is his subject, said, yeah, he thought it was possible. It was a little odd as a topic, but that there probably would be documents. And that I probably should pick one of the municipalities in England that had owned its own energy supplies, meaning its electrical and gas undertakings. Municipal socialism in the Midlands in England had inspired a number of towns on the model of Birmingham for the town to own its energy supply rather than have it be owned by a private corporation. He said, those might exist as records in the public domain, and you might be able to get access to those. He said, maybe you should look at Coventry. Take a look at Coventry. I'll bet there might just be records there that you could use. And so, to make a very long story short, I wrote off to Oxford in response to John Walsh's letter that I would do a study of energy supply in an English city, maybe using Coventry as the focus, based on David Ward's assurance that I might be able to do it. Would that be okay? And I know that the Oxford reaction, this is a pretty bizarre topic, but it's just a B-lit degree. It doesn't matter if he falls on his face, no big deal. And so they approved me to do it, and that was what I went off to Oxford in the fall of 1976 to research and do. But we can let that be the beginning of the next chapter. Are there calibrating questions you want to ask in the little time you got left?
Just one to kind of get us again to Oxford. I'm just curious, upon reflection, or maybe at the time if you were thinking about it, how does it feel to be, I mean, you've basically been in Wisconsin for quite a while, the bulk of your life by this point.
But you mean by now?
By 1976, whenever right. You're, what are your feelings about going, you know, across the pond?
Oh, they're very ambivalent. And that should be part of the beginning of the next, because okay. That actually is worth spending a little bit of time okay. on. Oxford really set me back, meaning I left here pretty cocky and pretty self-assured, pretty sure I knew how to play the game. And I arrived there, and within a month, I felt like I didn't have a clue.
Okay.
Didn't have a clue. And that feeling of not having a clue is an important part of the Oxford experience that deserves a little unpacking.
Okay. All right. Well, let's unpack that next time then, because okay. we're getting close to our 11:45 deadline.
Okay.
So thank you very much for your time today.
Sure.